against Glenn Maxson Companies. Mr. Olson.
Good morning. Please support. This appeal presents a single legal issue of non-statutory double patenting. Whether the earlier claim to a process to make a specific compound renders obvious the later claim to that same compound. The district court erred in basing its conclusion of no double patenting on simply the fact that the earlier claim was to a process and the later claim was to a product.
For which there is a very large amount of precedent. So you need to tell us why that doesn't apply.
First of all, there is a large amount of precedent that says statutory class is not control. The most pertinent cases here would be the In re Freeman and Taylor cases, where you had an earlier claim to a process to make and a later product claim. In Freeman, double patenting was found. In Taylor, the court did the analysis. There's no per se rule, no same invention double patent test. But in Taylor, the later product was claimed narrowly. It had specific limitations that provided patentability to the claim. There's no adverse authority, Your Honor, that we're aware of that would control in this case. The most pertinent, and of course, I think it, since the briefing has been completed, I think it bears mention then here that this court's recent decision in re Metoprolol certainly supports Ranbaxx's position here. And indeed, Ranbaxx's position, the facts here are more compelling than in re Metoprolol for finding double patent. Now, in Metoprolol, as here, the patentee argued that the General Foods case prohibited a finding of double patent. But the court rejected those arguments and concluded that the later compound claim there was obvious in view of the earlier claim to a composition that included that compound, but as one of a list of 11 different drugs. Here, the later compound is obvious in view of a process to make that same compound.
But it's not obvious in the site of 103 that we're looking at. We're looking just at the claims.
We're looking. That's right. We're looking just at the claims. And let's look at just the claims. The earlier claim 4 is a process to make a specific compound. That's what the claim says. The later claim is, I claimed that compound. Now, taking the claims in their entirety, that later compound must be obvious in view of the claim to a process to make that same compound.
It must be obvious, but you're not listening to Judge Newman's question. She said this is not 103 obviousness, it's about 101 double patenting. You know, maybe you're right, they're obvious, but...
Well, because we're in obviousness type double patent, it's not same invention double patent. We recognize that they're in different statutory classes, and therefore there is no same invention double patenting. The same invention has not been claimed twice. We understand that same invention double patenting, that statutory double patenting. This is obviousness type double patenting. Is the later claim obvious or an obvious variant in view of the earlier claim subject matter? And the answer here is clearly yes.
How could it be a variant? How can a compound be a variant of a process?
Well, an obvious variation, whatever, the test is it obvious in view of? Now,
no, actually, I think you stated the test exactly right according to our precedent. Is it an obvious variant?
Okay, whatever term you want to use. When I practice a process that's claimed and claimed for, I practice it in its entirety. The result is the later claim compound. I practice the two steps that are claimed in the earlier process claim, and I get the later claim compound. I have it. It has to be obvious. What could be more obvious? Otherwise, Your Honor, it would be a per se rule here. You would never have obviousness type double patent between a process to make and a later compound.
You've never had a case that said you should.
In Ray Freeman and Taylor are very important cases to look at.
They're product by process, so they involve process steps. And to the extent that Taylor allowed the patenting, it was because the process steps were more narrow, as you suggested earlier.
No, not the process steps were narrower. The product limitations were narrower, tensile strength and fiber orientation. It was the product limitations that were narrower. So the product was narrower, therefore it's patentable. But this is an important point that you raised.
Okay, so let me understand your claim about what Taylor stands for then. So it's the identity between claim 4, old claim 4 and claim 14 of exactly the same compound that is problematic. Is that right?
It's the same exact thing. That's right. But again, I'm looking at the claims as a whole, though, in their entirety. The second claim as a whole is a product, and the first claim as a whole is I practice two steps, and I obtain that same compound. That's the claim as a whole. So I hand a scientist a book with claim 4 written on it, and I say, practice this process. And he says, fine, I do step 1, I do step 2, and I get compound A. And then you ask that person, no, is compound A obvious with respect to what you just did? He'd look at you, what are you talking about? Of course it is. I have it. You gave it to me. The process, that's the objective of the process. I do want to make an important point here on the law.
Suppose that the process created many different things, not just the compound that was later claimed in 14. Many different things, but one of them was the compound claimed in 14.
Well, okay, now you're in a different fact situation. We're arguing on the specific facts here. You've got me into another fact situation. You're getting closer to a Prolol now, where now you've got a listing of 11 drugs. It wasn't just the one later claim, there were 11. Court still found double patent, obviousness type double patent. But that's not our fact situation, is the short answer. That's not our fact situation where you have a large group of potential products.
What if the process claim 4 didn't articulate the compound explicitly, but rather process steps which automatically resulted in the compound?
It shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter
whether... So it's not the disclosure that you're suggesting. It's not the disclosure.
It's not the disclosure. We're not parsing out disclosure. That would, there, if there was an issue as to what the result of the process was, and we could debate scientifically, is it this compound or that compound, that area of ambiguity is removed because it tells us precisely the single name compound. So it's helpful from that standpoint. But as long as we all agree what the compound is that results from that two-step process, and here it is a single-name compound, it shouldn't matter whether it's stated or unstated. Okay? Now, I'm back to Freeman and Taylor. I think this is an important point. To the district...
You corrected me and said my hypothetical is not applicable here, when in fact it is with regard to all the dependent claims except for 14, right? Because my hypothetical is not really a hypothetical. It is exactly your arguments with regard to claims 4, 8, and 10.
No, remember now, the earlier claim 4, the process claim, produces a single name compound.
Right.
It's true that the later claims, now we're talking about the 063 patent, the later patent. Yes, there is a specific claim 14, which is to that same named compound. That's got to fall as obvious. The other claims must fall as well, even though they embrace large groups of compounds.
It's not prior art to it. It doesn't fall in terms of patentability based on prior art. It's entirely the question of, is this invention, which is the process, the obvious in view of the product, and vice versa. I know we argued about this cross-reading and so on. but it's just the claims that we're looking at.
Yes.
And there you have to cross the hurdle of process and product, which I think we all agree may be different from product and the only use of the product.
But if we agree that claim 14 must fall because you've got the same compound that results, the other claims must fall as well because they're simply broadening.
Do you agree? You mean you and us, or you and your opponent?
No, I'm just saying hypothetically. If claim 14 is invalid, the other claims must fall as well because they're simply broadening the group of compounds, and you can't lend patentability to a claim by broadening it. If claim 14 is invalid, the other claims must fall.
That's not true. Claim 2 doesn't broaden it. In fact, it says you have to choose an effective alpha blocker, basically, an effective amount of alpha blocker. That's not broadening. That initial claim covers any amount. It is a process to manufacture any quantity of this product. And the resultant claim 2 says, use a composition with only an effective amount. How can you suggest that's broadening?
It's broadening in the sense that what you're doing is you're taking the compound which results from the process claim 4 and you're putting it into a conventional form. You're putting it in a pill. The group of compounds covered by claim 2 is broader than just the single compounds, tamsulosin. It's the compounds of claim 1. So we've got this large group of compounds, one of which is tamsulosin, which we're putting in a conventional pill. There's no meat in
it. Not a conventional pill, a pill with an appropriate amount of the alpha blocker that would be effective from a pharmaceutical standpoint to block with alpha adrenergic antagonistic amount.
Your Honor.
My clerk was trying to give me a shorthand ways to say that because I knew I'd bumble it.
The earlier the compound produced by claim 4 has an inherent utility. It has that alpha adrenergic blocking action inherently. That compound has that utility. Your Honor, you're just putting it in a form to provide that utility. It's a conventional pill. And the Geneva case is instructive here. Because Geneva says you don't do the claim construction in a vacuum. You can look at the sole disclosure utility. You're not going to do anything with this compound other than this.
These all apply to the 106 patent are to a process for making something.
Right.
It doesn't give you any idea about the quantity of that substance that ought to be utilized for purposes of particular treatment. It doesn't. It tells you how to make it. There's nothing in these claims that renders obvious choosing this effective alpha adrenergic antagonistic amount for pharmaceutically acceptable purposes. I simply don't see how there's anything in those earlier claims that can get you there.
Let me try. Okay. Effective amount, that phrase is never used in the specification, either patent. Not defined, not used. Effective amount means, and this is uncontroverted, effective amount is any amount which exhibits the utility. Any amount, it doesn't matter. Any amount that exhibits the inherent utility of that compound. That's what effective amount means. And as the Geneva case says, it's okay to use the term effective amount in a composition claim like this. If the amount is not critical, and it's not here, and one of ordinary skill could determine an effective amount with routine experimentation. All you've done, Your Honor, is take the compound that results from the process and put it in a pill in an amount that will provide the inherent utility of that compound. What could be more obvious than that?
Can you move on? Let's hear from the other side. You're exhausting your time as well.
All right, thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to get back to some basic principles of obviousness type double patenting, because I think there's been a little blurring of what the rules are. The premise of obviousness type double patenting, we start with the statute, section 101, and it tells us when we only have one invention, we can only have one patent. We can't have two patents for one invention. obviousness type double patenting was a development from that concept by judges. And it said, you still can't have a second patent if your second patent is an obvious variant of the first invention. So the critical thing is you have to compare invention to invention. And when Ms. Rolson says you've got to compare claim to claim, that's not exactly right. General Foods says you have to compare invention to invention. That's what the district court did here. That's what the General Foods opinion tells us that we have to do. And if you make that comparison, what do you find? We have a patent on a process for making compounds. That invention was based on process steps and reactants. It was not based on the identity or the properties of the compound. And why do we know that? We know that because the patent examiner allowed the process claims at a time when he said the compounds were not patented. Clearly, the process claims were allowed on the basis that the process steps were the thing that was invented. That process does not protect the compound. We can't list that process patent in the Orange Book. It's not infringed under 271E2. It doesn't cover the use of the compound.
Counsel, let me just ask you a question. The one thing that concerns me when we talk about double patenting are the policies behind double patenting. The idea that someone shouldn't be able to extend their monopoly. Okay, so you've got a process claim that makes nothing but this compound in claim four, earlier claim four. Then you've got a claim to that very compound itself. So for the number of years of the original patent, you were able to have a complete and utter monopoly on that process of manufacture. Now, we tack on the additional years for the second patent because you know what? That process makes nothing but the compound. So you effectively have secured a patent on the process for well beyond the statutory period and in effect have gotten at directly the problem that double patenting seeks to avoid.
With respect, Your Honor, no, you haven't. It's correct.
How is the process not being extended? That process claim doesn't make anything else.
Oh, Your Honor is correct that the product claim prevents somebody from practicing that specific process, but there's nothing wrong with that.
So you're saying it's okay for you to have a monopoly on process claim for about 17 years plus the 9 for the next one, so what is that, 26 years?
It's okay to have two monopolies when you have two inventions. And that is the point of General Foods. General Foods says at pages 1278, 1279, quoting prior precedent, that the fact the second patent dominates the first is not controllable. And it's often the fact that one activity is covered by more than one patent. The issue is, if we have two inventions here, if we have both a process invention and we have a compound invention, we are entitled to the monopoly on both of those inventions. The N. Ray Heinle case, which we've cited in our brief, was a case where the first patent was on a combination of elements, including a toilet paper roll. Second patent was on the toilet paper roll itself. No question that the second patent prevented people from making the combination that included the toilet paper roll. Held no double patenting. The Allen case, a whaler bracket, first patent was on a combination of elements. Second patent was on one of those elements, the whaler bracket. No question that the second patent stopped people from making the combination, but it's okay because there were two separate inventions. So the fact that the process can't be used, one of the processes can't be used,
What are the two separate inventions here? You've got a process for making something, and you've got a claim to the thing itself. How are those two separate inventions? In each of the cases you cited to me, there were other components that were relevant, other physical or tangible things. They resulted in two separate inventions. Here, you've got a process for making a thing and claims to the thing itself. And you did not have a restriction requirement initially.
Correct, there's no restriction requirement.
So you don't benefit from that portion of the statutory code that says we can't apply double patenting.
Correct. And I've already said the process claims were allowed because of the process steps, irrespective of any property or structure of the final product. That's why the examiner allowed them. And the process claims give no protection for the product at all, other than if you make it by that specific process. The compound claims were allowed because the structure was unique and the properties were unexpected. And in fact, tamsulosin is the most successful drug for the treatment of BPH. So we do have two inventions. We have an invention in compounds that have a particular use, and we have an invention in processes that can be used to make those compounds. Those are two separate and distinct things. One did not depend on the other. And as Your Honor pointed out, we also have a pharmaceutical composition claim. And that claim is not the product of the process claims. That claim requires more. It requires a pharmaceutical composition. It requires the recognition of a unique property of the compound. It requires an amount of the compound that's defined in terms of its properties. Entirely separate from the process for making it. There is no reason why these applicants should be denied the benefit of their compound invention simply because they took out a patent on a process for making it. They are distinct inventions. And I want to deal with some of the authority that Mr. Olson quoted. First, the Freeman case. I think, as Your Honor pointed out, in the Freeman case, you had a process claim followed by a compound defined in terms of the process. But more than that, Freeman was overruled in In re Bridgeford, and you'll find that in the In re Taylor decision. Freeman was decided at a time when the theory was that a product by process claim was not a product claim at all, it was only another process claim. That was overruled in Bridgeford. So Freeman is no authority at all. Geneva is a unique set of situations where first they got a claim on a compound, and then they got the claim on the only use of that compound. And that was held to be tantamount to repatenting the compound itself. If you patent the only use of the compound, you effectively patented the compound again. That doesn't apply here. It's simply because we don't have a situation where the first patent claims the compound and the second patent claims the pharmaceutical composition. The metoprolol case, with which I'm very familiar, in the metoprolol case, the first patent was on a formulation that had two polymer layers and it had active ingredients. One of those active ingredients could be the compound metoprolol succinate. The rationale of the panel, the majority panel in that case, was look at the composition claim. You can take out of it the two polymer layers because the majority concluded those were conventional. And then you're left with a claim to the compound. But you can't do that here. If you look at the process claim, and you take out the process steps. First, you can't because they're not conventional. They were the basis on which the claim was allowed. But if you take out the process claims, you're left with nothing. You're not left with the compound. You're left with nothing at all. So metoprolol doesn't apply here at all.
I'm just really struggling with 4 and 14 and 3 and 1. And how a process that makes that thing and nothing but that thing can't be obviousness type global patenting of the thing itself. I feel much more comfortable with, you know, your arguments with regard to claim 2, but with regard to claim 1 and 14, I'm just really struggling. We don't have precedent for this, and you agree truly this is a case of first impression.
I think on these facts it's a case of first impression. Certainly in the Taylor case there was recognition that a product claim could be patentable even though it was produced by the earlier process. And there may have been some differences in the limitations, but the case clearly says that product can be made by the earlier process. And in fact, it was made by the earlier process. So I think there is at least authority that says a product claim can be patentable over a prior process claim, even though that process can produce that same product. But Your Honor, I think the answer here is really going back to the principle I started with. You have to ask, are there two inventions here? You can't ask, does this claim make this claim obvious? Because that gets you into the trap that General Foods says you can't do. You can't go back and look at the words of the claim. You can't say, aha, I see tamsulosin in that claim. I see tamsulosin in that claim. Therefore, it must be obvious.
That's what General Foods is arguing. Don't use the claim as prior art.
I'm sorry?
Don't use the claim as
prior art. Cannot use the claim as prior art. And if you conclude, as I think you should.
But if we hold the way you want us to hold, I just feel as though we're then validating the notion that different statutory classes of invention are per se distinctions between claims.
That's my
concern, because we've got so much case law that says that can't be the rule.
Not at all, Your Honor. Not at all, with respect. You have to look at the facts of this case in the context of whether there were two inventions here or not. And one of the things you can look at is what I mentioned before. The examiner allowed these process claims at a time when he said the compounds were not patentable. That tells you that it's the process steps that were the invention of the process claim. And then later he became convinced that the product claims were allowable because of the structure and because of the properties of those compounds and the pharmaceutical composition claims. And at that time he knew that the earlier patent had issued, and he made no double patenting rejection. So I think you have to look at each case on its facts, and if you had another case like Freeman, where perhaps there were no distinctions between the process and the product, it was simply, the product claim was simply redefining the process steps, perhaps in a case like that, you could say there is no patentable distinction here. These are not two separate inventions. But here there are two separate inventions. And that should not be a problem for the court.
I have, this is peripheral, but may I ask it anyway. You said there was no restriction requirement, but I thought in your brief, you said that there was a restriction requirement in the case that preceded the one that was issued, not in the first one. Does that make any difference, or should we just assume there was no restriction requirement?
I think it's you know something that Your Honor can take into account. It does not get us the protection of Section 121. We concede that. What happened was in a later case where the process and product claims were still co-pending.
Yeah.
And this is after the process case had issued. The examiner made a restriction requirement. I think you just take that to show that the examiner at that point was recognizing that there was a patentable distinction between the process and the product. It happened the restriction requirement was mooted because the process claims had already issued. But then being aware of the fact that the process claims had already issued, the examiner did not make a double patenting rejection.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Burke?
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you.
The manner in which Astellas prosecuted these patents was their choice. They created the double patenting problem that they now have. They filed the 106 application claiming both the products and the processes. It was their choice to take the earlier patent on the process and then extend out the prosecution for years to get a later expiring product patent. Even though the 106 patent has been expired for years, no one can practice that claim process. No one can practice the claim process without infringing the later patent. Thus, it has been more than 24 years since the 106 patent was issued and 26 years since it was filed.
Now, the counsel cited some good points about the toilet paper roll or whatever it was, and how there are certainly many instances in our law in which you have a broader invention and a later invention that is more specific, and that in the end, you end up with an extended monopoly.
I understand it's not determinative, but this is the basis for this non-statutory double patenting doctrine here, and it certainly is here in spades in this fact situation. In re Freeman was not overruled. If only to the extent you would read, it's an early case, and the doctrine was developed, only to the extent that Freeman is read as a same invention type double patenting case would it be incorrect, because it was later clarified that a product by process claim is a product claim, not a process claim. And therefore, it would not have been same invention double patenting in Freeman, rather it would be obviousness type double patenting. And the holding in Freeman has never been questioned, and that case has been cited over and over. I never got a chance to say how this was stronger than in re Metropolol, and that is, at least in this one aspect, there are others. In Metoprolol, one could practice most of the embodiments of the earlier claim. One could without infringing the later claim. You could practice all the other 10 drugs. Here, in contrast, any practice of the earlier claim process of making tantalosin infringes the later claim.
Okay, I think we have the argument. Is there anything further in rebuttal? Or we don't want any repeat?
The last thought, Your Honor, this is not a question of patentability in the sense that we're not saying they're not entitled to patents on the processes and the products. It's a question of duration. It's a question of duration. They're entitled to one full patent term.
Interesting.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Bechtel, this is taken under submission.
All rise.